Hi, Corey.
Hi, Sarah. How you doing?
Good. I'm Sarah Posner, and this is The Posner Show, and today my guest is Corey Robin. He teaches in the Political Science Department at Brooklyn College. He is the author of the book, The Reactionary Mind, and he blogs at CoreyRobin.com. And we're going to talk today about the controversy that erupted when the Brooklyn College Political Science Department decided to co-sponsor an event, speaking engagement by Omar Barghouti and Judith Butler on the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, otherwise known as BDS. The Political Science Department at Brooklyn College decided to co-sponsor this event with a Palestinian student group. And then there was backlash from, well, who started the backlash? I know that there was backlash from local politicians, but who kind of got that ball rolling? I wasn't clear on how that all started.
Well, just to backtrack for a second, we got a request, I can't remember, it was in the first or second week of January, to co-sponsor the event, and the department decided to do that. And I'd say about a week later, we got a couple of emails from concerned students, one of whom was a major in the department, and so we felt obligated to respond, and we did. And this was before there was any kind of public controversy that had erupted, and we, you know, heard what the students' concerns were, and we explained why we thought it was important, nevertheless, to co-sponsor the event, and, you know, thought that that was that.
And was the student satisfied with that explanation?
Well, she never wrote back to us, so you know, technically I wouldn't know, but I, judging from some comments that were made in the press, I don't think she was. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I would say about 2 weeks ago, over the weekend perhaps, there started to be some reports in the kind of the local Brooklyn Jewish press, and then finally the New York Post, I believe, was the first, you know, larger media outlet to do a very brief antagonistic story on this. And then it...
And just to briefly explain the nature of the antagonism, was it, were there accusations that the BDS movement is anti-Semitic or anti-Israel, or was it something in particular about the particular speakers involved?
You know, at this point, the, I think Judith Butler said this last night, the accusations and the claims against this event have so accumulated that, and get so run together in, I think she said, you know, a sort of rapid artillery fire, that I couldn't even tell you anymore what was the specific thing that was said by the New York Post, because there's been so much controversy. So I really wouldn't want to characterize it. I just, you know,
right.
They basically were against it, and what the specifics were, I just couldn't remember at this point. It seems like a lifetime ago. But that was really, I think, what kicked the whole thing off, was the New York Post coming out publicly, at least in the public eye. I don't know what was going on behind the scenes. I'm not privy to. Mm-hmm. How the opponents of this event operate.
Now, at some point, was there an effort not only to raise objections to the content of what was going to be said, or what they thought was going to be said at the event, or to the BDS movement in general, but was there an effort to get the entire event shut down, or was it just an effort to get the Poli Sci department to withdraw its co-sponsorship?
Well, if you read, you know, what people were saying to us in emails and publicly, they were sort of all over the map on this. Sometimes they would say, you know, just to be clear, we're not asking for this to be shut down. It's really just about the co-sponsorship. But then they would immediately go into a whole, set of claims about the event itself and how it really shouldn't be hosted at Brooklyn College. And it was sort of toggled back and forth between all of these. There were, you know, to be fair, I think there were a couple of voices that were at least consistent in what their demands were. But on the whole, you know, we were, you know, you have to remember this is all happening in real time, where you're getting, mm-hmm. you know, email after phone call after article after blog post coming at you. And I would say many of the people who were writing and criticizing us weren't really all that consistent in what their actual demands were.
Well, would it be even possible, I mean, even if the Poli Sci department had withdrawn its co-sponsorship of it, the college can't stop the student group from hosting? Can they stop the student group from hosting an event?
Well, legally, I don't think that they can.
Yeah.
Whether or not they,
this is a public institution.
It is a public institution.
Yeah.
Yes. Whether or not they could put pressure on the student group quietly, you know, to do something like that is you know, a very different question. I don't want to, you know, I want to be clear here. I'm not suggesting that the Brooklyn College administration would have done that. But
right.
You know, certainly,
we're talking about hypothetical.
Yeah. Certainly, college administrations have quite a few tools at their disposal. You know, in order to discourage events and speech that they feel will put them in some, you know, negative light.
So at some point there was a group of local politicians, and they were people who have served in local government and members of Congress who got involved with this issue too.
Yes, there were, in fact, it was almost simultaneously, or maybe within, you know, one day or another of each other, there were two letters that were issued publicly but addressed to the president, Karen Gould, of Brooklyn College. One was from a group of self-declared, and I believe this letter came out first, a group of self-declared progressive politicians. And just to give you a sense, you know, who we're talking about, four were members of Congress. It seemed like this letter was actually organized by or I don't know this for sure, but there's been speculation I've heard, and just the ordering of the signatures, it seemed like the letter was organized out of Jerry Nadler's office. He's a congressman from Lower Manhattan, mm-hmm. a Democratic congressman, you know, generally liberal, but very, you know, down the line pro-Israel. So Jerry Nadler's office, Jerry Nadler signed it.
Just so you know, that on this program, the word pro-Israel is hotly debated. What that means. But anyway,
okay.
Go ahead.
Whatever. I think, well, anyway, I'll leave that to you guys, the experts, to debate this. So Jerry Nadler, Hakeem Jeffries, who's a congressman recently elected here in Brooklyn, Yvette Clark, who's another congresswoman from Brooklyn, and then Nydia Velazquez, fairly liberal Democrats, signed it.
And was there a particular demand in that letter?
I'll get to that in 1 second. I just want to, again, give people a sense of what we're talking about here. And then there was the top mayoral candidates all signed it as well. So Christine Quinn, who's probably going to be the next mayor, who's the Speaker of the City Council, John Liu, Bill de Blasio, who has a very progressive reputation in New York City, and John Thompson.
And ultimately the sitting mayor, Mike Bloomberg, took an opposite.
Later, that's true.
But we'll get to that.
And he was not on this letter at all. And then a whole bunch of state legislators as well were. And their basic demand was and it was addressed to the president, is that she should have the political science department withdraw its co-sponsorship of the event. And the way the letter was framed, they acted as if we had I mean, if you look, not to get into the syntax of the letter, but it was the political science department has basically constructed a one-sided panel thing, you know, in that nature of the claims, which was, you know, completely contrary to the facts, which if they had ever, you know, bothered to make a phone call to us, they could have easily found that out, but they didn't. They shot first and asked questions later.
So the accusation that the political science department had organized a one-sided panel was incorrect just because the political science department hadn't organized it at all. They were just asked to co-sponsor.
Exactly. And just so people understand, I don't know, I would imagine some of your listeners are academics and some are not, but, you know, events get organized and planned on campuses all the time, you know, many by student groups.
Right.
And what they do is then they come to different departments and programs and they ask for co-sponsorship. And in our case, you know, really what that literally means is we attached our name to the event. That's it. You know, they didn't ask. In fact, I should say, and this is another detail that that they've not picked up on very much in the press, is that we were asked explicitly, would you wish to co-sponsor or endorse this event? And we vote, you know, we decided to co-sponsor it. So
you specifically did not, the jury did not accept.
Exactly. We were given a choice, and we explicitly did not.
Interesting, because I thought, I guess it was Alan Dershowitz on the Daily Beast, I thought that his piece on this suggested that he thought that, I hope I'm remembering it correctly, that the department had, in fact, endorsed it.
Yes, this would not be the first time that Alan Dershowitz was, proven not to exactly understand or know all the facts of the matter. So that was what we decided, and, we didn't give any money. Again, not for, you know, we don't have a lot of money to give out in the first place, so we wouldn't have. That was it. These politicians, like I said, these more progressive politicians, that was their demand, that we withdraw our co-sponsorship and address it to the president. Almost simultaneously, or again, there might have been a day, this is where the things really got heated up, was there was another letter from a group of city council, members of city council, I think 10 of them, led by a man named Louis Fidler, who's also a council member from Brooklyn, which also included some very progressive people, like Brad Lander, who's a city council person from Park Slope, who has followed me on Twitter for a long time, like I said, fairly liberal, fairly progressive. And their demand, their letter was even more disturbing because it was fairly explicit in the letter, and people can read it for themselves, that should the department not comply, or really should President Gould not be able to engineer the compliance of the department with their wishes, they would start seeking the cutoff of funds from Brooklyn College's operations, which is, you know, an extraordinarily serious interference on the part. I mean, it's not just government officials voicing an opinion, which, frankly, can have a chilling effect in and of itself. It was an explicit statement of a threat, you know, that we'll cut off your money.
I think that's when there was such a outpouring of support for the idea of free speech and academic freedom.
Exactly.
It was after that letter in particular where the funding was threatened, because it just seemed, I think that's when even people who were adamantly opposed to the BDS movement and are no big fans of Butler or Barghouti or anything that was going to be said there still were shocked at the idea that public officials would seek to not only dictate to an academic institution, but also condition funding on compliance with their demands.
Right. And I think what's important, doubly important about what you just said, is remember, many of our critics, one of the leading claims against us was that we were, in fact, this is in the progressive politician's letter, that because we had, we in political science allegedly had, you know, excluded voices from the other side of this campaign, you know, again, which is just factually false, we had deprived people of their right to speak, and therefore we were the threat to academic freedom. That was the claim. That was one of the very strong claims that was being made against us. And then simultaneously with that claim being made, you had a government, you know, body, as you've just said, threatening to cut off funding should merely because they did not like the content of the speech that was being propounded on the campus. And, you know, there's a lot of debate about what academic freedom means, and, you know, you can go back to the AAUP, they have a lot of statements, you know, this goes back to debates with John Dewey and Bertrand Russell, I mean, it's an old debate, but there's a pretty strong consensus, I think, that whatever you think it may or may not mean, one thing that academic freedom does require is that the government does not use the power of the purse or the sword to compel or hinder speech on an academic campus. I mean, it's a pretty straightforward understanding. And so when they did that, I think not only did it rouse a lot of public opinion, you know, in our favor, and as you say, even people who are not at all pro BDS or anything like that, you know, to really, you know, look askance, I think even more important is that it put those progressive politicians and all those who were claiming to speak on behalf of academic freedom against us in a very difficult position, because here you had a much, much more blatant assault, and they were silent on it, you know. You know, you can look at Twitter exchanges, you know, with Brad Lander, with another city councilman, Jumani Williams, who didn't sign the Fiddler letter but sent his own letter to the president saying that he was concerned, you know, about the lack of balance, you know, in the name of academic freedom. And yet they were, you know, kind of silent for a while on this Fiddler letter. And then slowly, because people, you know, their constituents really started, you know, calling them and calling them on it, you know, I think Jumani Williams' first comment was that he thought the Fiddler letter was silly. You know, and then he moved it up to, you know, pumped it up to ridiculous. And I think, you know, by the end, you know, he's finally realized that, you know, it's actually a pretty severe thing for government to do, and it should never be in the business of doing that. But it...
Well, and then Bloomberg comes out and says, you know, if you really want your universities to be like that, you should...
Right. And that was, you know, a further build-up. I don't want to bore, you know, the listeners with it. You know, when you're involved in these things, every single little detail and day and hour and minute seems like a big deal. I can imagine from afar it doesn't quite seem that way. But, you know, the Bloomberg thing was really, in some ways, the final piece of this, because what happened was... on Monday of this week, you had the first person who had signed on to the letter, Letitia James, to the Fiddler letter. She pulled her name from it. She publicly rescinded her signature. Then I think Stephen Levin was the second. He did that on Tuesday. And so they were, you know, basically jumping ship because they realized it was a sinking ship. And the New York Times came out with a very strong editorial in support of our position, not anything about the BDS issue, but our co-sponsorship.
Right.
And then finally, right. You know, I think when Bloomberg made his statement on Wednesday, it was. That was really the sort of the final thing. And then,
right.
You know, literally within less than an hour of him making that statement, all those progressive politicians, not all of them, but all but two, I think, of those progressive politicians who had signed that initial letter, wrote a second letter, basically completely backtracking from everything they had said and, you know, doing the right thing.
So, okay. So to me, looking at this from afar, it seemed to me that now just I have a lot of questions about the BDS movement as, so I just want to put that out there. But it seems to me that by giving it this power, so its detractors gave it more power by making it seem like it was self-threatening to Israel, well, to Israel, really. You know, which obviously is its goal, is to be threatening in a nonviolent way to Israel. But it seemed to me that if no one had said anything about this, that, you know, you had just co-sponsored, the Poli-Sci Department had just co-sponsored the event, 20, 30, 50, 100 people came, it happened, and then everybody went home. I wonder, you know, it's the tree fall in the forest thing.
I mean, I think it's a good question, and I think I have a two-part answer to that. I think the first part is you're absolutely right. I think, you know, I should also say, you said you have a lot of questions about BDS. I've not been remotely involved in the movement, you know, at all. I really actually have no firm opinion about it. You know, part of the reason why we thought it was important to co-sponsor this event was precisely because many people don't know very much about it and have questions about it
right.
and want those questions answered.
Right.
So, you know, you're talking to, I mean, I'm only speaking for myself here. I can't speak for the rest of the department on this at all. But that was my, you know, personal feeling. You know, I've certainly written on the topic of Israel and Palestine, and, you know, I think I'm on the record about that. But in terms of the actual BDS movement, I really, you know, don't have a strong opinion about it. So I think you're right that they put this issue on the map in a way that I just don't think would have ever happened. I had heard from one of the organizers, or somebody on the line was saying, you know, yesterday at the event that that Omar Barghouti ended up in a meeting with the New York Times editorial board about this issue in the last couple of days. Excuse me.
Because of what was going on at Brooklyn
Hall. I don't want to quite say because of what was going on, but I think it brought the issue to the consciousness of the New York Times that they thought, oh, we really
Right.
We need to find out about this thing that everybody's, you know, going on about.
Right.
So I do think that's true. But the other thing, on the flip side, though, and this was not something I would have said before last night when I attended the event, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but I'll say this. I can now see why a certain, you know, I know you don't, it sounds like the word pro is really contested around here, but whatever, a very hardcore defender of a certain kind of intransigent position, I don't know, whatever you want to call it,
right.
would be
right.
extraordinarily nervous right. about allowing this kind of speech on the campus, and for the following reason. The voice and the figure and the words of Omar Barghouti is not the voice, the face, and the figure that many on that side of the issue of the Israel-Palestine question want to see in the United States, because he's not the boogeyman and the monster and the stereotype that they have built up about this movement and or about the Palestinian cause.
About the BDS movement in general, or just about?
I would say about the BDS movement in general, or frankly about the Palestinian cause as a whole. You know, it's again, you know, I'm not an expert, so I'm really I'm speaking at a distance on this. You know, and there are people who study this far more and know far more about it than I do. But my suspicion is, you know, it serves a certain purpose to have, you know, a certain kind of stereotype of, you know, Ahmadinejad, or, you know, a certain kind of notion of Hamas and Hezbollah. You know, it serves a certain purpose for this group. And someone like Barghouti really, I think, disrupts that narrative in a fundamental way. You can, I guess, try to turn him into a monster. It's kind of hard, you know, having heard him. And so they don't want somebody like that on the campus, because it threatens to disrupt a narrative that works very well for them in terms of securing, continuing, you know, sort of down the line support by the United States government of what the Israeli government does.
Well, I actually was looking at it in a slightly different way, and that was this. I just thought, why would you want to stick your head in the sand about the fact that this movement exists, right? So if you are quote-unquote pro-Israel, mm-hmm. right, and you want to make this thing, this movement, this appearance at Brooklyn College or at other universities just go away, that's a huge mistake, right? Because then you basically are acting like it's illegitimate, we won't discuss it, it doesn't deserve a hearing in polite company, essentially, right? And so, but by doing that, you're calling on your followers to stick their head in the sand about the existence of an actual movement. Now, you can discuss, as the day is long, the virtues and drawbacks of this movement, its problems, its strong points, but, you know, whether it has issues, moral issues, or functional issues, or operational issues, or, you know, whatever. I mean, those are things that, you know, are debatable and are debated. But by acting like the movement is so illegitimate, we won't even discuss it, we won't even give it a hearing, one day you're going to wake up and see that a lot of people have looked at you putting your head in the sand and looked at this movement going around and persuading people of it, or maybe not persuading people of it, whatever. But, I mean, but if you are just putting your head in the sand about it, I think that eventually things like that come back.
Well, you know, the group that you're saying is putting its head in the sand, whatever name we want to call that, it wouldn't be the first time in history, let's put it that way, when in the face of a social movement, the response of the group against which the social movement is mobilizing is intransigence, denial, and its head in the sand. I mean, there's nothing particularly unprecedented about that. I mean, I don't disagree with what you're saying, but it is often the way, you know, groups in power respond to challenges and threats to their power.
But in this case, I think that is right. But I think in this case, it's not really a challenge or a threat to their power. I mean, it could be. At the moment, it is not. And it gives it more power to act like it's so so controversial or so threatening that we must not even let it see the light of day.
Right, right.
So, well, let's talk about what it was actually like last night. So you went, and the sky didn't fall.
No, as far as I know, Brooklyn College is still standing as of, you know, 2 p.m. on Friday. I haven't gotten any phone calls. No, I mean, you know, this was, you know, there's a lot one can say. And the first thing I would say is, you know, it turned out to be an ordinary, slightly controversial event on a college campus. And, you know, to all of you out there who, you know, are in college or have been to college, you know, I suspect this kind of thing happens all the time. You know, certainly I remember when I was an undergraduate in the 1980s, we had, you know, speakers, I mean, all the time. You know, the big issue back then was the divestment movement. I remember John Conyers came, Jesse Jackson came, you know, and it was, you know, it was the big event, and you went and you heard them speak, and, you know.
You're talking about divestment from South African countries, right?
Yes. Yes, I guess I should have made that clear. You know, and so to some degree, that's what this was. But what people need to understand is that that's something that Brooklyn College students don't get to do a lot. And I talked about this on my blog this morning, or late in the middle of the night, actually, I wrote it. And, you know, a lot of this debate happens at a very abstract level, and it also happens among people in the media who I suspect went to, you know, fairly elite universities or, you know, fairly elite private or public universities where this kind of stuff goes on all the time. And the fact of the matter is, at Brooklyn College, it doesn't go on all the time. You know, we're a completely underfunded institution. Our students, most of them work full-time, if not more so. It's a commuter campus. You know, the students don't have a lot of time, and they're certainly not given a lot of opportunities to go hear Judith Butler on their campus, you know, or Omar Barghouti. And so, you know, for the students who were there, and you could just see it, this was like a real intellectual experience for them. I mean, the notion that somehow or another this is just some sort of political rally. I mean, if that was a political rally, I think the BTS movement is a little bit in trouble because there was nothing rallying about it. You know, I've been to rallies, right. You know.
Was there a Q&A? Was there questioning of the speakers contesting
Absolutely.
Their positions?
Yes, there was a Q&A. Unfortunately, it had to, you know, because the whole event was so long, you know, there were people, of course, who were still online and didn't get to answer to ask their questions, much less answer.
I understand that there was security, and that's why the line took a while.
Yeah, I mean, there was incredibly intense security getting in.
And who initiated that?
I actually have no idea. Yeah. I would imagine it was some agreement between the... Well, actually, I just don't know.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
It was Brooklyn College security, or was it NYPD?
It looked to me like it was, you know, a combination, I guess,
mm-hmm.
actually.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think a lot of Brooklyn College actually security is NYPD anyway. Mm-hmm. I don't know for sure if they have a private security. I don't think they do. But anyway, you know, so there was a Q&A. There was, you know, a wide variety of views represented. I mean, you know, you had your usual, you know, on the pro-BDS side, you had a lot of, you know, people who just, you know, made speeches. And what was kind of nice for me was to see the moderator, who's an undergraduate, a woman, you know, very tentatively inch her way to start becoming, you know, a real moderator. And by the end, she said, you know, would you ask your question, please? And, you know, she did a great job. And so, you know, it was a real educational experience in that regard. And you could see the students who are anti-BDS, you know, really struggling to formulate their questions in a way that kind of got at the heart of the issue. And both Judith Butler and Omar Barghouti, you know, pushed them to kind of refine the question, you know, in a way that any professor would do. You know, when you have a student in your class who asks, you know, kind of a vague question, and you know there's something there, but you push them to figure out what the question is. The other thing that was very interesting, I was told that the big, there was, you know, a fair amount of protest outside, was actually between two groups of observant Orthodox Jews. I mean, a lot of people don't know this, but, you know,
there are Orthodox Jews who are anti-Zionist.
Very anti-Zionist, you know, entirely for religious reasons.
Right.
And they were out there arguing with the pro-Zionist Orthodox Jews, you know, which, you know, and that's the other component. This was a very Brooklyn event, you know.
Right. You wouldn't have this at every college or university that these speakers went to.
God, no. You know, you would never have that. You know, and so, you know, I just thought to myself, for the people, and, you know, forget the sort of ultra-Zionist, hardcore pro-Israelis. I'm talking more of the middle road, you know, types who just thought this was just inappropriate and you know, all the rest of it. I really wonder, you know, like, there's something weird about this. It's almost saying that Brooklyn College students don't deserve what students at Yale or Princeton or Berkeley or, you know, or anywhere else get to have every day as a matter of course. And I think for all the posturing and all the politics and the question of Israel and Palestine, that, in the end, to me, was the much more fundamental question is, do our students get to have the same kind of education? And I would ask anybody who's listening to this to remember their college education and to think to themselves, was it just the things that happened in your classroom, or was it not also the kind of intense debates that were generated by events on the campus and college speakers who were invited in? And so I'd ask all of you, you know, who are, you know, not sure whether or not this should have happened, even with the aegis, you know, the aegis of the political science department, you know, why not? You know, in what world was this a bad educational experience? And I would really defy anybody to give me an answer to that.
I want to probe you a little bit more on why this was such an unusual event, not because of its substance, but because of just having speakers from outside the college come and talk on a topic, and you're saying that this is largely due to funding constraints.
Yeah.
Of the student groups themselves and of the university's academic department.
Yeah, I mean, we just, you know, we just don't have a lot of, you know, money to do this kind of thing. I mean, there are speakers who come in, don't get me wrong, but it's, you know, you go to any website of a top university on any given day of the academic calendar, and you're going to see, you know, tons of events, tons. And
you just
don't have that at Brooklyn College.
And speakers on all sorts of controversial issues.
Yeah, of course,
also.
Of course. And, you know, you just don't have that. And it's not just the question of the funding that we were just talking about, but it's also the fact that our students are not wealthy. You know, a lot of them are, you know, working class students, they're immigrants, and they have to work. And, you know, they just don't have the luxury to go to stuff like this. And in the end, I felt like what, you know, aside from the sort of ultra-Zionist pro, you know, or you know, whatever we're calling that crowd, for whom the issue, you know, it's very clear what's going on. I felt like for a lot of other people, you know, they're perfectly happy for working class kids from Brooklyn to just, you know, be, you know, working round the clock and then, you know, just punching in and out of their classes. And that's the beginning and the end of their education. And that, to me, in the end, is what was sort of almost the most appalling thing of all.
But do you think that part of their concern was motivated by the fact that they know that there are so few events like this for students, and that this might have given this issue an outsized importance or outsized attention? I mean, I'm not defending the position of people who sought to shut it down or make funding contingent on shutting it down, but I just wonder if there was a little bit of the substantive pushback that we got had to do with the fact that, well, we don't get stuff very often, and this seems like a very controversial or introduction to
my
Israeli...
tab is now appearing on the screen.
That's fine.
There's a tab that's flying around here.
But that this is a very one-sided or controversial introduction to this complicated topic, the topic being just generally the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Well, I think I would reframe that in two ways, actually. One, I would say there's a fear that if this topic can be discussed in Brooklyn, at a school that has a sort of historically Jewish, large size of Jewish population, that if it can be discussed there, it can be discussed anywhere. And I think that was, frankly, I think they felt like if we can't win this in Brooklyn, we're not going to win it anywhere. And by this, I don't mean the debate on BDS, because, of course, that's barely even begun. I mean whether or not we're going to have a debate on it. You know, the first order of business is, can we even debate this? And I think it was very important for them, and I suspect they thought they could really win it, which is why they kind of overreached in the way that they did. And I think that was very important. And then the other side, and it comes up a little bit in that Fiddler letter, was a sense, and it speaks to this other issue I've been talking about, which is, you know, you guys are not a wealthy institution, and what the hell are you doing with your limited resources funding this? You know, and again, you should ask the student group I have no idea what the money came for any of this stuff, right?
But the political science department did not.
No, absolutely not. And, but, you know, I think there was a real question on the part of those government officials that, you know, and this is where I talk about this, the impoverished idea of education that they have, that, you know, funds are scarce and you shouldn't be using it for this stuff. You know, you should be using it for other stuff. Setting aside the obvious fact that I don't think any government money was probably even used for this. But that, you know, there was that attitude. And again, it just speaks to these class divisions we have where it's like, it's fine. You know, the children of the ruling class and the power elite, you know, in the Ivy League, they, of course, can live in this, you know, John Stuart Millian paradise where, you know, we debate the great issues of the day and we hear all sides and we go back and forth. They get to do that. But, you know, for working class kids, forget it. They don't get it. They don't deserve it. And I think there was some attitude like that as well.
Do you get the sense, and did you get the sense at all in the room last night that this, setting aside the academic freedom issues for a minute, but just focusing on the substantive issues, that this did have the effect of starting some kind of discussion on campus, if not about the BDS movement itself and the pros and cons of it, but about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict more broadly?
You know, I'm probably not the best person to speak to that because I don't really have access to both sides of that debate. Let me first say one thing. This is not the first time this has been a flashpoint at CUNY or Brooklyn College. I mean, this is actually the third time now in the last 2 years that I have myself been involved in a campaign around this question and its role on campus. So 2 years ago...
The BDS question in particular?
No, Israel-Palestine. So 2 years ago, my department hired an adjunct instructor who had written a paper on issues related to all this, and that caused a huge furor with some of the same actors on the other side, particularly the Assemblyman Dov Hykind. So, you know, that was a huge fight, and we won on that. Then the next flashpoint was the awarding of the honorary degree to Tony Kushner, and that became a huge fight, and we had to fight on that. And now this one. So, I mean, I think this has been happening more and more on the campus. And I have to say, there was a quote from one of the Jewish students in one of the Jewish press, I can't remember which, who said, you know, this used to feel like it was our campus, and we don't feel that way anymore. And I think... that was a very honest, I don't think the student was making that up. I don't think it was in a sense that some people claim that, you know, somehow or another students are getting penalized by the political science department for their views on Israel, which is preposterous. But I think, you know, historically, Brooklyn College was really identified for Jewish students from Brooklyn. And, you know, they're finding that they have...
My parents both went
there. Oh, really? Yeah, I mean, everybody. I know, I talked to everybody. It's like, oh, my father went there, my aunt went there. You know, I hear this all the time. A lot of the students are finding that they have to share the campus with Muslim and Arab students, some of whom are, in fact, from Palestine, or their families are from Palestine, and they're having to confront this. And as painful as I can imagine that process is for those students, and frankly, on all sides of this matter, and I think I have some sense of how painful that can be, and I'll give you a little tangent. I myself am Jewish, and, you know, I was brought up like most Jewish kids, very pro-Israel family, and the first time I ever heard a criticism of the state of Israel that wasn't, you know, remember, you know, I grew up in the 70s and the early 80s, so, you know, the criticisms were, you know, from Arafat and, you know, the PLO and something like that. The first time I ever heard a criticism was when I was a freshman in college, and my roommate, who ended up becoming my closest friend, had spent the previous summer in the West Bank on some kind of archaeological dig, and had a fair amount of criticism of the state of Israel and its policies. And I can't tell you what a culture shock that was to me. I mean, it was shocking. And I don't know how else to say it. So, you know, I think I have a little bit of a sense of how some of the students might feel about this. I wouldn't say completely. And I think, I guess what I would just say to everybody is, as difficult as that experience is, in the end, that is what college is all about, is exactly that. And right. Working that through, this goes back to Socrates, you know, the gadfly of ancient Athens, you know, and it's something Martin Luther King also spoke to in the letter from the Birmingham City Jail. You know, that sense of conflict, of dissonance, of difficulty, that is what education is all about. I think the adults, I mean, everybody's an adult, but the sort of, let's say, the elders of this debate on the Israel side of this, the Alan Dershowitzes, the Dov Heikins, they are just, they're doing such a disservice to their children and their grandchildren. And it's wrong. It's wrong. And this is not what, you don't send your kids to college just so that they can think the same things they've always thought. I certainly was changed by my college experience, and I think many other people were. And to deny that to these students at Brooklyn College is just, it's just wrong.
Well, listen, I really appreciate you talking to me about all of this. It was a good discussion.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
All right, well, maybe we'll do it again sometime about a different topic.
Sure. Sounds good.
A similar related topic. We'll see. Thanks, Corey.
Okay. Thank you.